Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Selling Greenville, your favorite real estate podcast here in Greenville, South Carolina. I'm your host, as always, Stan McCune, realtor right here in Greenville, South Carolina, and you can find all of my contact information in the show notes. Need to reach out to me for any of your real estate needs. And just a reminder, as always, if you like this content, please like it physically on the app that you're using. Subscribe, make sure you don't miss future content. If you can leave a rating or a review, all of those things would be phenomenal as well. And I just thank you guys for listening or watching. Today, we have a very special guest. This is John Nolan, the owner of Greenville History Tours and the president of the Greenville County Historical Society. I've recently went to a presentation that John gave to a small group of us that included the mayor of Greenville. Phenomenal presentation. I immediately went to him afterwards to say, hey, would you be willing to come on the podcast? And after a few weeks of figuring out the exact timing, today was the day that worked. So, John, thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
So, John, I just want to just start right away because probably half my audience will probably have some sense of who you are, maybe half won't. But tell us a little bit about what you do, you know, in those capacities as the owner of Greenville History Tours, as the president of the Historical Society.
Yes. Okay.
I'm going to pull up your website while for those that are watching on YouTube, they can see your website here.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, I started this tour business, and I have always loved history. I was an art major, studio art major, but I took a lot of history classes and
Looks like John got frozen out there for a second.
Was elected, you know, you could really start to sense things were changing. And so I kind of recognized that there were no tours in Greenville and there were a lot of visitors coming. And I had had some tour experience before in a museum and really enjoyed engaging people with cool historical stuff. And so kind of saw the need. And started reading everything I could about the city, its history, and there was a ton there. And so I started thinking, okay, how could I do this? And so I came up with some routes for some walking tours and figured out what I would say, what I would point out, found a lot of great historic pictures of places on the route that I could show people, you know, how things have evolved and changed. So I started up 20 years ago with just a couple of walking tours. And then a couple years in, I started doing driving tours. People started asking, you know, can I have a driving tour? So I started to do those. And then about 4 years in, I took a food tour up in New York City and had never heard of food tours before that, and took one, and it was awesome. Had an awesome time, and learned a lot of history of the area, but tried great restaurants, great food. And so I came back to Greenville and like, okay, I need to add food tours to my business.
Absolutely.
And then, so that was 15 years ago that started up. So, you know, as Greenville has grown, I have really recognized that, you know, I need to grow with Greenville too. So over the years, I've expanded my offerings and I'm always thinking, you know, kind of what's next. And so currently I have 8 different historic tours of the city, 4 that are walking, 4 that are driving. And I have 6 different food tours, different themes. So it's been pretty amazing seeing how this business has evolved.
Yeah.
The support of the mayor, of Visit Greenville, of so many people that have helped along the way. And I estimate about 100,000 people now that I've given tours and given lectures to over those 20 years.
That's
So it's been
incredible.
quite a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. So how many, in just kind of a standard week, how many tours are you typically giving?
Say 10 to 12 on average
Okay,
between
wow.
the history and food tours.
That's amazing. And I'm actually having issues. Zoom is giving me issues. It actually cut out a second ago. That was, in case people are wondering, that was on my end. That was on your end. I had some kind of a internet disruption, but we got the main gist of what you're saying. I just wanted to make sure people knew what was happening there. So in terms of when people are taking your tours, what are, maybe let me ask it this way. Is there like a certain thing that you know is always going to surprise them or delight them? Just something that's like, okay, you kind of got in your back pocket. You know that this is going to have some kind of a response, or you know that the average person simply doesn't know this fact or whatever that they're going to be interested in. I'm just curious.
That's a great question. I've got so many facts that I do, but I over time I've tried to distill it down to a lot of zingers,
Right. Well, you want me to tell you the one that you said that I heard that I retained that was the most surprising to me was,
Sure.
and you'll probably tweak exactly what it was, but basically that the oldest existing structure in downtown Greenville is that fountain right across from Nosedive. Did I
Yes.
get that right?
It is. It's the oldest thing downtown.
What's it called again?
It was a fountain for people to refresh themselves along the old road coming from Charleston to Asheville, and spring water was fed into it, piped into it from nearby, and it was along that r dirt road that Joel Poinsett, laid out back in 1820.
Trying to see if there's an image of it online. What would I search for to actually pull up an image of it?
Poinsett Spring, I think, is
Poinsett
what it would come up.
Spring, Greenville. Now, there, when I pass by it, yeah, I'm not able to find a picture. Oh wait, actually, I did find a picture of it. Hold on. Let me share my screen for those that are watching online. There we go. Poinsett Spring historical marker. That's doesn't look like where it is currently, but that is the correct spring, is
No,
it not?
it is. And it's interesting because it is now in its third location. The photo you're seeing there is when it was in front of Sobeys.
Okay, interesting. So there's water in it. Where is that water currently coming from?
So they bring a pipe up from, one of the buildings. They just kind of brought it out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, in terms of like Greenville as a whole, right? Obviously, Greenville has an interesting history, from just a lot of different angles. But I feel like Greenville, the upstate, if we want to call it more broadly, has kind of reinvented itself multiple times in ways that I feel like is kind of odd for a city of our size, and in a region of our size. So I'm curious, what are a few, if you can just kind of give us, the audience a sense of some of the formative events that kind of put Greenville on the map, made it what it is today.
So I think there's three kind of identities for our city over time. Back in its earliest days, we evolved into being a resort town for people from Charleston. We didn't have
Which is going to be funny to
industry.
some people hearing this. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a lot of ongoing, if ever anyone like online, like on like a big site like Twitter or somewhere like that, post something about Greenville being like one of the best, cities to go to in South Carolina, people from Charleston are always chirping that
Right.
they're better. So it's ironic to me
Right.
that people from Charleston were going to Greenville for a vacation.
Yeah. Because it's so hot. I mean, it still is today. And
Right.
they don't necessarily think of going to Greenville now because of air conditioning. But people were so desperate to get out of that humidity and heat. So if you had money, you would get out of there, at the beginning of summer, stay away all summer, and then come back. So up here in the foothills, Greenville, going up further into Asheville, Hendersonville, Brevard, we were all places that these Charlestonians would frequent in the summer. So that's what we began as. And beyond that, we were agricultural. So,
What
we
were people
grew a lot
doing
of.
in Green? If I can interrupt for 1 second, these
Yeah.
people coming here from Charleston, what were they doing? Were they just not being hot? Was that, or were there like actual things to do?
Yeah, I think it was pretty much a vacation for people. I mean, they had enough money where they didn't have to, start some other business here to get in. I mean, I'm sure that they were corresponding with some businesses they had, but I mean, even to send mail, I mean, it would take a week for a letter to get from here back to Charleston,
Right.
for them to talk with people about what was going on in the summer. So, yeah, I think they kind of just hung out and enjoyed their families and the time together. Yeah.
All right. Can
So,
continue on. I didn't mean to sidetrack you there, but I was just curious.
we did have crops here, and of course, the low country, cotton and indigo and rice were the big crops. Up here, it was more wheat and corn and tobacco. So we actually were a pretty big tobacco growing region before North Carolina took it over, So up until the 1870s or so, we were a lot of tobacco and corn. And some of these people that would come up from Charleston would take care of farms too, up here.
Yep. And so then from there, what were kind of like the next kind of two or three
Yes.
whatever big moments that kind of
Evolutions.
got us here? Yeah.
Right. So the Civil War, game changer for everybody. And that was in the wake of the Civil War, was the changeover from being agricultural, no industry, to textiles. So the industry was all in New England up until this point. All the mills were up there. We were growing all the cotton down here, but it was all being sent up to New England to the mills. And so after the war, that industry started to shift down here. And there's a number of reasons for that. One, transportation costs. Why send cotton up north when you could build mills down here? Northern investors started building mills down here.
Sure.
And after the war, there was a lot of cheap labor down here. So that was another reason. And Boston, being the center of the textile industry, it had a fire in the 1870s. And a lot of the cotton merchants and owners' businesses burned down, and they came down here to kind of start over.
Interesting.
So that was the big shift after the Civil War to start to have textile mills, which got bigger and bigger, over a few decades. And that's when the shift from tobacco really started to go over to cotton. We had grew some cotton here, but if there's going to be mills all here in the region, having it close by was just made sense. So by the 1880s, 90s, Greenville, Anderson, Spartanburg, we became some of the leading counties for growing cotton in the state. So that was a shift. So that
Yeah,
was the
absolutely.
second iteration of Greenville, was two textiles. And that's what put us on the world map. You know, as a resort town, we were regionally known. As textiles, by 1910 to 20, we were being called the textile center of the South. So that was more nationally recognized. And then by the 1960s to 70s, we were the textile center of the world. So that's when the spotlight really got us onto a bigger stage.
And for those
And
that
then,
are
of course,
not from Greenville that are listening to this, like that the imprint of that era is everywhere. Everywhere you go in Greenville. You know, the old mills that are still standing, obviously Falls Park, which we'll, yeah, I'm sure talk about later a little bit more in this conversation. But I mean, you can't escape the textile. Like you can be unaware of our tobacco history and whatnot, but it's very hard to escape the history that we have in the textile industry.
right. So yeah, that was the second iteration. And then, of course, when textiles started to leave Greenville and the South in its entirety, that's when we had to reinvent ourselves again. And that's when we diversified more. It's definitely more automotive focused with Michelin and BMW, but we have a lot of Asian countries here, European investment, GE, you know, doing gas turbine plants, Bausch + Lomb. I mean, for so long we were pretty much just textiles, and now we have a wider base of product.
How did that happen? I mean, I've heard the mayor talk about recruiting, you know, these businesses and whatnot, to the city, and I guess the county has done some of that as well. But from your perspective, what exactly happened to bring some of those larger corporations to the upstate?
It was a real concerted effort between the governors at the time and senators and mayors here. So, like Carol Campbell, Strom Thurmond, you know, they were involved in trying to recruit these companies here. And Mayor Max Heller, of course, being mayor in the early part of our changeover to where we are now, he was hugely instrumental. I think with Michelin, especially, even after he was mayor, I think he, you know, had a hand still in politics with some things with BMW. But yeah, it was a real effort between the different entities in our state. It wasn't just our mayors, although they were very big in that.
When you say governors and senators, were they just trying to bring it to South Carolina, and then it just kind of naturally these companies assessed all of the South Carolinian cities and decided to go to Greenville, and maybe if you went to Columbia, if you went to Charleston, if you went some other areas, or was it specifically an effort for Greenville?
I think in the 70s and 80s there, the concentration really was Greenville. You know, I can't really think of big companies that were locating, you know, in those other regions at the time. And, you know, part of that was, you know, we're on this great corridor of I-85 between Charlotte and Atlanta. We're right in the pipeline to ship a lot of things efficiently, you know, throughout the Southeast and other parts of the country. And then, of course, bringing in the inland port, you know, going directly right to Charleston, that was a great move. So I think location had to do with it too, and tax breaks, and just some leaders that really pushed to get us in the forefront, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're here now. Obviously, you know, I mentioned Falls Park before, right? And that's when people think about at least downtown Greenville. That's oftentimes what they think about. I've talked a little bit about the history of Falls Park, but I'd be curious, for you to kind of share, just you can go through the history of it, or you can tell us something, it may be interesting that the average person wouldn't know about that history. I'm just anything like that.
I one of the little geeky things for me is seeing old maps and descriptions of dams that have been along the river over the years because
Scams.
dams.
Oh, dams. Okay. Sorry about it.
So, they were using that water for powering different industries along there. And so they would have to channel the water over there, try to control it as much as they can. So, up river on the River Walk, kind of by the White's Pavilion over there, and a little further down by River Street, there used to be dams up that way. And then on the upper falls, where everybody, all the families take their kids out, and they all, walk around on the beautiful area on the upper falls there. That there used to be dams across there. And so actually there's remnants of those dams too. So I was just a few weeks ago. I knew that there was a water race coming from the river to channel water over to the Camperdown Mill, which is, kind of where the Grand Bohemian is, over that way. And so if you walk down to the banks of the river there and you look at some of those rocks, you'll see some steel bars that are coming out of the rocks and are trimmed off, but you can still see the metal bars there. And those are remnants from, that old race from the mill.
How
So
about
that's
that?
awesome.
That's interesting.
Yeah, kind of.
I've just got a picture of just the falls for people to see, and that area of White's
So,
Pavilion that you were just mentioning is all the way back there,
yep.
through
So
the
the area
trees
I'm
there.
talking about now with those bars is in this photo would be in the upper right, along the banks over there. Yep. And then that same side over there to the right, there's a, the railing where people look over to the falls. And underneath that railing is a kind of a stone wall. And that wall is a foundation wall from the Camperdown Mill. So that's an old piece. And then that drain that's coming out there, that's kind of a carryover from the old days too.
Oh, okay.
But
Interesting.
yeah, there's just a few little remnants. But if you look hard enough, and in fact, over closer to the Liberty Bridge on that where it comes in to the land over there by Grand Bohemian, there is a little bit of a brick structure that's left from the mill as well. It's kind of hidden by vegetation now, but if you know what you're looking for, you'll see it.
Somewhere in this area, this is an old photo here.
That's right. Yep.
But you're saying this area over here, is there not one that has the Grand Bohemian in it? Let me just look real quick. Scrolling through random photos on here. No. I'm probably not going to find it. But where in relation to that hotel?
So it would be kind of underneath where the Liberty Bridge comes in over on that side,
Okay, got it.
down on that kind of precipice area.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's crazy how there's so many of these. We need more drone photos that are recent of Falls Park, because these are all old. So,
Right.
one thing that's interesting is how young Falls Park is as a park. Well, actually, that's a good question to ask. When did it become called Falls Park? Is that a recent name, or was it called that for a long time?
Right, that's it. So It opened in 2004, and that's when the signage and everything was really, put in stone, literally, and all that. That's a good question. If it was referred to much before that, it wasn't really a park,
Right.
so it wouldn't have been called Falls Park.
That would be my assumption as well.
So, but the Riverwalk, that was earlier. So after they did the Peace Center in 1990, they started to make that area nicer with some trails and that bridge and
Again, near the Weish Pavilion, that little
correct.
section. Okay.
Exactly. So, and it they landscaped it kind of over to the Upper Falls. Even though the Camperdown Bridge was still going over the falls, they made it a nicer connection landscape-wise between where the White Pavilion is and the Upper Falls. So that, micro riverwalk was really in place from the early 90s until they really finished Falls Park in 2004.
So where this sidewalk here ends by the Weish Pavilion, it's kind of like along this area that you're talking about, continuing that way.
So, yeah, if you look at old pictures from the 90s and the early 2000s before Falls Park, that was already kind of nice over there, not expensive, but it was clearly before Falls Park.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. So, one thing that's fascinating to me is just how people considered that area, the area around the falls, like prior to it becoming a park, right? Because it was basically my understanding is that it was not a place that you would go alone at night.
Never. Yeah, to the person. And I've been here 34 years, and I have talked to so many people who just say that same mantra over and over. You didn't go over the bridge. In fact, a lot of people say you didn't go past the Poinsett Hotel.
Okay, interesting.
That was the turnaround. Court Street, like when people were still cruising. In the 80s and into the 90s, and they would turn around there at Court Street and go back up Main, and yeah, there it was too much crime and unsafe across the river. And I talked to somebody who worked at the Greenville News, which is right where the Camperdown Plaza is and the AC Hotel. And he worked there for years and wasn't even aware that we had a waterfall.
That's
He
wild. That's
was
wild.
that close and never realized we had a waterfall.
So I'm going to tell you
That
something.
to, yeah.
Sorry, you can finish your thought. I was going to tell you something funny.
No, it's just astounding that
Yeah,
that
that is
awareness
astounding.
was not there.
It's like 100 yards away from it.
Yeah.
So I went to Bob Jones from 2000 to 2008. Sorry, 2004 to 2008. That was how I actually ended up in Greenville. And Bob Jones at that time, I don't know a ton about what the rules are like now, but it was pretty strict back then.
Right.
So there was not a whole lot of opportunities to go off campus. And in 2006 or 2007, I think it was 2006, someone from my high school that was younger than me went to Bob Jones, and I was still friends with him. And his family came, to drop him off as a freshman, and asked if I wanted to go out with them, before the semester started to get something to eat. And we went downtown, and I had been basically living in Greenville for 2 years and had never been downtown before. And I was like, this is really nice. Like everything, all that I knew was that was the yellow brick of Bob Jones. I did not know anything about, Like, I literally did not know that there was a downtown Greenville or that it was like worth going to.
Yes.
And so that was kind of amazing. I saw the waterfall for the first time. I was like, this is sweet. This is like, I need to go here every now and then. But
Yeah.
I didn't go back again until I graduated, funny enough. So but it's crazy how things like that can be right there. But sometimes I feel like as locals, we can ignore the things that are in our own city. So my wife and I, we oftentimes do a staycation once a year. So we've stayed at Hotel Domestique. That we had a great, phenomenal time at Hotel Domestique. The time that we stayed there. What a great experience. And are they under new management or something? I heard
Maybe
some rumor about
management, but
something
not
like that.
ownership.
Right.
I believe
Okay.
it's,
Okay, I heard something. I wasn't sure if it was accurate or not. I'm curious in that vein, what are some things that locals tend to not know about in this area that are like, listen, you need to know this, like to enjoy your city.
I think that people should try to understand our textile past because there are mills and they're obvious and people live in them now, but and we everybody knows they've heard the phrase textile center of the world. But I think to really understand what that was like for Greenville, what mill life was like, what kind of products they made. I think that that's that kind of thing only increases people's love and appreciation for our city
What's the best
because
way for
Greenville
them to
is
do that, to learn
to
more
take
about
my
that?
tour.
Okay.
I have a textile mills and villages tour, and
Okay.
I go to seven of the mills and their villages. And we go all around in my tour van. I have literally hundreds of photos that I show them on a TV screen of what life was like, what it looked like 100 years ago, what products they made, what village life was like. It's pretty immersive. So I think that that's the kind of thing that, I like to say Greenville is so easy to fall in love with. I mean, you can walk down Main Street, a visitor for the first time, and they will feel the vibe, and they'll look around and they're like, this place is awesome. And even people that live here who enjoy it, like to go downtown, eat, and go to the parks, when you can start to understand more about how we got here and the foundations and the building blocks, your love and your appreciation grows that much more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that.
So I really, that's part of really my passion and my joy is to share that with people.
I remember there being something about one of the mills was like the largest in the area. What was that little factoid that you shared that I heard?
Yeah, so the Woodside Mill from 1913, probably for the next 30 to 40 years, they were labeled as the largest mill under one roof in America. So it's 69 window bays long. I've counted it. It's five stories on one side, four on the other. And, it's just so massive. You go over there and it's overwhelming how huge it is.
Yeah, for sure.
And so yeah, that's again, when you start to bring into the conversation things like in the world or in America, biggest or best or whatever, that's significant.
Absolutely. Yeah, and Greenville punches above its weight, I feel like, in terms of some of those things. What do you so I to my shame, I've still not been to the Shoeless Joe Jackson Museum. Is a museum, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that something that you hear people when they come to town that they talk about, or is that kind of an under the radar thing?
Well, it's just something that a lot of people want to experience and go to. But unfortunately, I hear a lot of frustration because it's only open one day a week
Ah.
and hours are pretty limited.
Sure.
So, some people will only be here for a couple of days and they're not here just in that window of time to see
Right.
it. So that's unfortunate. But I mean, I've talked to the guy who heads it and they're really trying to address that and to change that, especially with the fact that Shoeless Joe will be in the Hall of Fame pretty soon. I mean, it's just a matter of time now that he's going to be elected in.
Sure.
And when that happens, his profile notoriety is going to skyrocket. And we kind of need to be ready for that wave of new interest
Yeah.
in him when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a
So
great place, and it's the actual house that he lived in. And here's a little factoid that's pretty cool. Next time you go past it or go in, the address on the front door, the house is on Field Street, and the address is 356. And they obviously chose that because that is his lifetime batting average,
oh, how about
and
that?
it's his address
Cool.
as well.
That's fascinating. Before they tracked OPS and it was just batting average back then.
Right.
So I want to talk about, you were talking about the mills and whatnot. So obviously, as a realtor, I've sold a lot of mill homes, the little mill village style homes. I mean, tons of them in Dunedin, in Judson, in Poe Mill, in even out in Greer, in down towards Conestee, like they're everywhere. So and I had told you before the show I might ask a question like this, but I'm curious, are there any little pockets of Greenville that have kind of interesting before and after stories?
I mean, my specialty is the downtown area, and there's some neighborhoods that have been more stable over the years and others that have evolved quite a bit. An example would be Alta Vista. That has remained stable. It's one of the most desirable neighborhoods in the
Sure.
city, and they never really had a downtime where it went downhill and the rich people moved out or whatever. Whereas Hampton Pinckney, it's the oldest neighborhood in Greenville, and it has lots of 1800 homes over there. But in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, it was pretty rough. And boarded up houses or boarding houses and homeless people. And so that was a prestigious neighborhood, then not, and then now it is again.
Interesting.
And so that's evolved quite a bit.
Is there a reason
And
for like that it went through kind of that downturn kind of period? Was that just something where the city was just, not policing the area as much, or what was going on there?
I'm pretty sure it's because of its proximity to downtown, because that time period, 60s, 70s, and 80s, is exactly the period when our downtown took a nosedive and was abandoned, and all the department stores went out to the malls, and
Yeah.
all of that.
Interesting. What about I'm curious about Poe Mill. I used to own some property out there. So I don't know where it is currently, but I know that at some point it was supposed to be redeveloped.
Yes.
I know the mill sold a few times in recent years. I'm not sure where things stand. Maybe maybe you don't, but
I do.
what do you know about that? Because I'm curious.
Yes. So, you have two of the closest mill villages in Greenville right there. You have Poe Mill and you have American Spinning right across the tracks. Two huge mills and villages. So an investor bought American Spinning and took a while to really rehab that building, and finally got it open a couple years ago, or maybe less. But it was never fully redone. And all the amenities that were kind of promised to the tenants didn't really develop. They had planned a food hall there
Yeah, I
in
remember
the
hearing about
American
that.
Spinning Building. Yeah. So over the last year, I've heard some, really bad reviews of people who live there and just kind of the unsafe nature of it, and just the amenities never really came along. And that same owner who developed American Spinning also owned the property at Poe Mill. So all of that land, which needed to be addressed, where the mill used to be, there was some sort of requirement where they had to put in, I think it was 6 feet of dirt, new soil over the whole property. So over
That's a
the
lot of
last
dirt.
year or more, I saw bulldozers doing that very thing, a bunch of dump trucks bringing in dirt, and they did it. And there were renderings put out for the new apartments that were going to go up there at Poe Mill. And they were going to keep the two smokestacks, and the new apartment buildings were going to be brick and have kind of the curved windows up top like the old mill windows. And it looked great, I thought. But that was never realized. And so I think that the compounding thing of the requirements of the land at Poe, and then some of the hurdles they were facing at American Spinning, they went into foreclosure just a month or two ago. So the tenants got a quick notice, like their water's being shut off
Oh
and
my
this
gosh.
and that, and it was a mess.
That's awful.
So it's in transition right now. I mean, I don't know if how many people have moved out, but they're looking for a new owner.
And this is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's already, I believe the county had it, and then they sold it to someone, and then I believe that that person sold it to the current owner being foreclosed on, I
Okay.
believe, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about some of that, but now it's going to be changing hands again,
Yeah.
presumably. So that's interesting. Well, hopefully it'll change hands to someone that actually will develop, will give that area what it deserves.
You're absolutely right, and we have so many success stories of
Right.
mills that have developed, and
Yeah, the
this
blueprint
one
is
is
already
the,
there.
yeah. So this is the only one who really has failed. So I don't know if one of those other successful ones might take it over and, apply the things that they've done or what, but it's the closest of all the mill sites. I
Right.
mean, that is right, almost a couple stones from Main Street.
Right.
So it's the potential is unbelievably huge right there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, just a few more questions, John, and then I'll let you go because I know that you're a busy man, and I'm sure that you're constantly probably having to research for this job. That would not be the part of the job that I would enjoy, but someone's got to do it.
Oh man, it's the
Yeah,
part I love the most.
that's what I figured. That's what I figured. I saw that on your website, that old photo, of you from however many years ago with books out and whatnot. It was just like,
Yeah.
yeah, I can see the vision there. So, what, generally speaking, what's the feedback that you get from people when they go on tours with you, just about Greenville? Good, bad, ugly.
So generally it's wow, whether it's newcomers, visitors, or whether it's people who've been here but don't get downtown very much, I really keep up not only on the history, but what's happening now? What are all the projects going on around town? So it's kind of overwhelming. When I take people through, they see so much and they learn so much about how the city has evolved and what's going on now, what projects are going on. So it's generally pretty astounding to people. And I often hear, people in the back rows saying, "I want to move here." And this, I mean, that you get that all the time. But then you have, some others who really resent the growth and the development, and they, but that I would say that's the exception on the tours. I mean, I hear that more online, a lot of complaints, but on the tours, it's generally positive. And one of the things that I have always appreciated the most is, I'm not from here. I moved here 34 years ago, and not being a native and being a local historian, that can rub some people r wrong way sometimes. But when I can take a native on a tour, and at the end they're like, "I learned so much. This was awesome. I loved it." That's the best compliment to me.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that's what I really strive for, to know the stuff. But I know that I'll never know the kind of thing that people who lived here know, and experienced. So I'm always trying to learn from those people who really experienced it and what their perspectives are, what their experiences are.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm sure, people that like actually, were here 50 or 60 years ago and got to experience multiple different mayors and all of that, that would be a completely different experience. And I wish I had that. I was in New Jersey through high school. I would rather have been in Greenville. No slight at New Jersey. I do still like it up there. It's a good place to visit. I would not say it's a particularly great place to live, but that's neither here nor there. So you do your food tours. I know a lot of your food tours are based on the Table 301 restaurants are
Actually,
heavily
only one of
featured.
them.
Only one of them.
Just one of them.
Well, I'm a big Table 301 fan. For those that aren't familiar, that's what Sobeys, Nosedive, what's the Mediterranean, Lazy Goat, they've got
Camp.
the Camp. They isn't don't they have something in Malden now at Bridgeway, or is
Yeah,
it
Tavola.
Tavola? So I've not been to that one. I've been to all the other ones. They're all phenomenal. But what are some, from your perspective, just some very obvious places that people need to eat at if they haven't yet, or maybe not so obvious.
So, doing food tours, I feel it's my job and responsibility to know about all the restaurants.
Of
So,
course.
a couple of years ago, I made a list of every single place downtown that makes freshly prepared food or drink. And so, block by block, I have a running list. And so, if something closes, if something opens, I update my list. And I've made a concerted effort to go to every single one of them. And finally, about 2 months ago, I made it to the last place that I needed to visit to have been to every restaurant downtown. And since then, three have opened. And I've been to one, but two of them I still haven't been to. So, it's always a thing that I'm always going to be trying to catch up on.
For sure.
But I really, having getting able to know the managers, the owners, the servers so well over the years, it's wonderful. And it's always nice to be able to recommend things to people. So that being said, I would say my top five would be Camp, Scoundrel, Coral, Gianna, and probably DeMarco's. But I just went to Black Sheep a few weeks ago for the first time, and it was fantastic. And their menu
I've never
looked
been there before.
really good, really creative. And it's like, I want to go back and work my way through the whole menu. And you know, Cork and Cleaver just opened, South Main Social just opened. I went there and had a Frito Misto the other day, and it's a take on tempura, vegetable and shrimp tempura, but it was prepared unlike I had ever had, and it was really good. And I love being surprised by food. You know,
Yeah, for
it's,
sure.
you think you always kind of have had it, but when you have something and you're like, oh, I've never had this, or I've never tried it just like this, I love that.
That's great. It was a really a shame. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but the restaurant that closed on Markley Street,
Oh,
what?
Urban Ren.
Urban Wren. That one hit me hard. That was my favorite restaurant in downtown.
Mine too. It was my favorite.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's where Cork and Cleaver is now.
Okay, yeah. So I've not yet been there. I think my current favorite in Greenville in general is the Patterson, not downtown,
Oh,
obviously.
yes. Yes.
But
Very good.
I love the Patterson. Just the entire vibe and the experience.
Yep. And they just got a new chef in recently.
Oh, did they? Okay, that's interesting. I'll have to go back there. I think my current favorite downtown is probably Camp, probably. But I've not there. There are several. I'm not quite as well traveled in the food scene as you are. So there's several that I've not yet had a chance to experience. So I've got to up my game here. There, yeah, and my internet connection went out for a second there, so I might have. Did I freeze for you?
You did, but you're fine now.
Okay, hopefully the audio didn't freeze. But anyway, but what I was saying, I haven't been to as many restaurants as you have downtown. There's still several that I need to try, and I'm hoping to. I too have a list. Now it's not quite as exhaustive as your list. My list is more of
I'll
like.
send you mine.
Okay, send me yours. I would definitely like to see that. Do you have like a rating system? Have you gone through and been like,
I don't. I just kind of keep it in my head. I take pictures of
sure.
everything, of course, and I file everything. So I have, and that's another thing, you know, with what I do, my involvement, both in the culinary world and just Greenville history. I try to document the city as best I can. Over the last 10 to 12 years, I've really made a concerted effort to take photos of everything and not just the pretty stuff, you know, things that are fields or, you know,
Yeah.
ugly and, you know, knowing that one day those are going to change quite a bit.
For sure.
So I have photographed everything for years and years, and it's always great to look back and compare. But yeah, the food, if I like something, I'll post about it. I'll say, you know, what I enjoyed. If I didn't like it, I won't post.
Understood. What's the besides Urban Ren, what's another restaurant that comes to mind that's no longer here that you regret that it closed? Hear people talk a lot about Devereaux's. I never got to
Yes.
make it there.
Devereaux's was special. They used to be on my tour when they were here, my food tour. I think American Grocery is one that's real by a lot of people.
Yeah.
They were maybe a little ahead of their time,
They
at
were
least.
for sure ahead of their time.
Yeah. Boy. I mean, there are some places that you say the word and old Greenvillians will get nostalgic like no other. And some of those places would be like Vince Peron's or Ye Olde Fireplace or Jean's or Charlie's Steakhouse, Never on Sunday. You know, these places that were pillars in our city's food scene for so long, family-owned, you know, recipes that you can't taste anything like it anywhere else. And, you know, they're just great aspects of our history. And Yeah, the old Green Millions love that. I
Well,
mean, we all
thankfully,
do. I mean, we all can think
yeah.
of places that we grew up going to that are just tied to our memories.
For sure, for sure. Well, thankfully, despite having had some that have closed, we still have a lot of fantastic options in the area. And constantly, I'm just amazed every time, I might walk Main Street once a month, and every time I walk down Main Street, it's like, okay, I've never heard of this place. It's just like constantly. And I used to work on Main Street before I was a realtor. I worked with a business for almost 10 years, and our office was on Main Street. Now, this was starting from 2008 and onwards, so a lot of Main Street was boarded up. When
Right.
I would be walking Main Street and being like, well, at some point this will turn around. And then yeah, of course it did. Now it's, there's a now the city is kind of picky with its tenants. They can pick and choose, whether they want Lululemon to be there or not. Which the mayor has said it's one of their best producing stores in the country, is that one in downtown Greenville. Yeah, he took I went to a presentation that he did where he said that, which was that's incredible. Again, Greenville kind of punching above its weight. But one last question, okay? And this isn't if you're gonna say right now, that's fine. But if there's one era of Greenville's history that you could live in, what would it be?
I might say the 1920s
Okay.
because that is very similar to right now. Greenville is changing, it's exploding. We're, economically very strong, very vibrant, all of that. 100 years ago, same thing. 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. I mean, the country itself was, pretty prosperous. But that was when we were being called the textile center of the South, and all these mills were just churning, and
There
we're
had to be
getting,
an energy in the city back then.
our skyline was changing like it is now. It was changing monthly or, real regularly. So I would say, yeah, 1920s.
Okay. If we could just have the 20s and not the 30s, right?
Right, that's
All
exactly right.
right, John. Well, where can people find you? And I'm going to include your information in the show notes, but if they want to find more information about you or your business or anything like that, where should they go?
GreenvilleHistoryTours.com. That's where all my ticketing is, and you can see the schedule for all my tours. And I would say also the Greenville County Historical Society, which we haven't really talked about. GreenvilleHistory.org is the website, and we got some exciting programming going on now, and we have an incredible resources for photos and maps and documents, directories. So we would love to get more people, especially the younger crowd and middle-aged, to really become more involved in the nitty-gritty history of of that organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there you go. Oh, and well, I'll ask one more question about your business. On your tours, how many people do you typically take, and are they typically can you if you've got, a couple, I assume that they can join with other couples, or it can be like the entire group reserved. If you could just explain that real quick.
So, with walking tours, we can go up to 20, 30 people. But we'll take two people. So two people's generally the minimum for tours. But we'll get a lot of neighborhood groups, friend groups, social groups that will book out a tour or a whole van full of stuff for a private tour even. But like say a food tour, I would say 6 to 10 people would be pretty average for like a barbecue tour or chef's table tour or something. The history tours, maybe 2 to 6 people on average. But again, I've done a lot more than that in groups. So I always entertain, whenever somebody wants a group, yeah, bring it on. We'll do it.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, I think that's a great way to end it off. So thank you so much, John, for your time and for just sharing all of that knowledge with everyone. Like I said, if you're interested in connecting with John or doing one of his tours, which I would highly recommend, you can find his contact information in the show notes on whatever platform you're watching or listening to this on. You can find mine as well if you need a realtor. And please like, rate, and review, subscribe, all of those good things with the show. Thank you guys for watching and listening. We will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Dan.